This week, the southern U.S. braced for impact from Hurricane Matthew with 107-mile-per-hour winds recorded in Cape Canaveral, while the precious metals face their own financial typhoon. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with you this weekend. Another highly volatile week for the markets, and lots to discuss with some top guests yet again. Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, returns to the show. He's been predicting a major financial crash, and the markets seem to capitulate to his forecast, but he's stockpiled millions in the yellow metal as a hedge against runaway money printing. Then Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of Institutional Advisors, returns. He thinks that the sell-off could lead to buying opportunities in the precious metals, as do we. We discuss the Deutsche Bank share collapse, and we open up the phone lines for John in San Diego, who happened to call in at just the right time. He compares the Deutsche Bank fiasco to the Great Depression and a similar bank failure. And I added about 10 huge dividend stocks to our Alpha Stocks newsletter list on Thursday evening, many of which have already moved higher, poised to move higher as they like the volatility. Investors turn to the higher yielding stocks, many of which are recovering and oil related, trusts and REITs and things of that nature. So if you'd like to take a look, be sure and log in. And if you haven't signed up, you can receive bonuses just for signing up now if you haven't already. And we'd like for you to help support us. Help us keep the lights on here. We're approaching our 11th year free of charge for everybody listening in. And we could really use your help. We have a fundraiser right now. It'd be a big help. You can find the information at the website or in the email messages. And also remember, please click our sponsors. It helps keep things running smoothly here in the studio. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Heavy weather appeared over the precious metals. A Category 3 hurricane loomed over the markets on news of a solid U.S. dollar rally. The yellow metal sold off $64, finishing at $12.53, down 5%. Silver fell $1.83, finishing at $17.40, off about 10%. The precious metals XAU shares finished off about $12.69, almost 14%, finishing at $94. Nevertheless, black gold did buck the trend, moving sharply higher, up about $1.60 per barrel, closing around $50, up 3%, following comments from the Russian energy minister, which lowered expectations of production cuts and, of course, very robust CRB market action. Meanwhile, according to a Bloomberg report, Goldman Sachs Group says strategic buying opportunities may be opening up. As the metal sells off, investors continue to look for ways to protect their portfolios against increasing risks. Clearly, the market weakness, though, stemmed directly from U.S. dollar strength. The greenback simply continues to defy collapse. Even amid a two-year extended head and shoulders pattern, investors expect Fed policymakers to increase the benchmark overnight lending rate. According to the Fed Funds futures contract, odds are twice as high that rates will increase at the upcoming December FOMC meeting. Of course, that assumes that the U.S. elections go smoothly and are not contested as we saw earlier in the last decade. Elsewhere, Goldman Sachs analyst agreed with Bloomberg that the gold ETF holdings are solid, few signs of liquidation. It's primarily held by institutional investors. Of course, those deep pockets are clearly holding on to gold amid increased volatility. Goldman analysts called for 1,300 as a potential target. Nevertheless, I downloaded the GLD holdings data, and I noticed conflicting numbers within the XLS spreadsheet. There was a small but noticeable downtrend in holdings in recent weeks, which they didn't, for some reason, list. Now, while this doesn't indicate in any way liquidation, I think it is an interesting anomaly on their part. Precious metals, bottom line. And there are signs of capitulation showing up. Gold, silver, and the XAU all found support at the 200-period moving averages. Even more positive, I think, are proprietary sentiment indicator, which simply refuses to budge amid the strong sell-off. It really should be plunging by now if this were the end of the bull rally. I think this suggests that smart money and the herd are beginning to use these sell-offs as bargain buying opportunities. In addition, the bullish pattern in the CRB and in black gold suggests better things ahead for the precious metals. I expect the markets to find a bottom as soon as the next week or so. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrials fell just 68 points for the week, ending at 18,200. 240. The S&P 500 fell 15 points, finishing at 2153 for the week, while the NASDAQ Composite fell 15, finishing at 5292. The top story pushing equities lower stemmed from the Labor Department, which announced on Friday only 156,000 jobs were added in September. The number was lower than expected, and of course the national unemployment rate inched higher to 5%. That unanticipated uptick in the jobless rate suggests that the Fed may have less wiggle room to raise rates, and the economy might be starting to lose some upward momentum. Investors feared the Fed officials might ignore the jobless number and pull the trigger anyway on rates this December, which does appear likely, according to the odds. Bottom line on equities. Well, markets just dislike uncertainty. We have the two storms battering the U.S., the contentious presidential election, and the Hurricane Matthew. Once those storms pass and more favorable seasonal factors return, I expect buying opportunities to emerge. The VIX index does appear ready to soar as soon as next week, which might put further downward pressure on equities. Currently, the Alpha Stocks newsletter is following several high dividend stocks, which tend to move higher despite all this volatility, and they have the added benefit of a 10, 16, 17% dividend yield. So if you're interested, please log in or you can sign up. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us. It's a pleasure to welcome back Robert Kiyosaki.
Thank you, Chris.
Robert, I wonder if you could give us your outlook on the U.S. markets. We've had an interesting year.
I predicted in 2002 the biggest market crash was coming in 2016. And as you know, the market crash hasn't come because it's been propped up by the Greenspan put financialization and easy money. So the market has not crashed, but what has crashed is interest rates have gone below zero. That is the biggest, most radical thing I have seen. It's in the history of the world. Never have we had negative interest rates. So you have countries like Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Japan, Germany, Spain, all going negative interest rates. It means that pension plans like CalPERS, the biggest government pension plan in the U.S., California, you know, whatever they stand for, they base their actuarials and returns on 7% per year. At 0%, they can't pay the baby boomers their pensions. And so the person listening to this thing right now who has a government pension or a 401k or an IRA, negative interest rates means even though the Dow is at all-time highs. So that's really what I watch, and I listen to people, and Yellen didn't raise interest rates, and it's just a sham. So anyway, that's what I watch.
I think you're right, and it looks like, you know, they don't have a lot of wiggle room to raise rates, because every time they talk about it, some other, you know, negative economic event seems to pop up on the news, and it looks as though there's some talk they might reverse the direction on rates and go negative as the BOJ and the ECB.
To me, it's good news because I'm a debtor who has a pension, IRA, 401k, or a government pension, has no idea what that means. That's what I'm trying to say to people. I borrow money constantly. Susie Orman and those guys, they're trying to get out of debt just because of interest rates.
That's a big part of it. They're confused. They don't realize that maybe if they take on too much debt that they're going to find themselves in trouble. And do you think that there will be an economic revival, or will they have to resuscitate the economy again?
See, debt makes people like me richer. So in the last few years, I've financed or refinanced $500 million worth of loans because I'm a real estate guy. I'm not a stock market guy. I don't pay income tax because I am a real estate investor. If you're a stock investor, you're paying tax. And there's guys like me who don't pay tax. I'm trying to tell you, there's guys like me who use debt and don't pay tax.
I'd like your thoughts on the amazing 100% move in gold stocks.
I have a lot of gold, but I don't play the paper asset game. I don't have REITs, real estate investment trust. I don't have gold ETFs or silver ETFs, nor do I have gold mining share ETFs. I play it as a hedge, an insurance policy against governments printing money and printing stocks and printing bonds. I don't trust paper. So I would rather have physical gold and silver, not as an investment, but as an insurance policy against people like Janet Yellen and Bernanke and Greenspan. These guys have not a clue what's going on. Hold gold and silver as an insurance policy, not as an investment. I count gold and silver in number of ounces that is stored in a private vault hidden someplace. That's what I count. I don't trust paper. Anything that can be printed, I don't want to touch right now.
we've seen housing starts soar and continue to stay strong now ever since the bottom in 2012. Do you see more positive things ahead for the sector?
Every time Yellen says she's going to raise rates, it's because she wants mom and pop to rush out and buy a house. It's all manipulated. I mean, even gold and silver prices are manipulated, as you know. I just don't trust anything that's paper. If you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which came out almost 20 years ago in 1997, I said, your house is not an asset. And mom and pop are out there buying a house because they think it's an asset. And you look at The Millionaire Next Door. The Millionaire Next Door in 1996, when that book came out by Stanley, by 2005, The Millionaire Next Door was the foreclosure next door. People forget that really quickly. So for all the people who are millionaires next door because they're making $1 million a year in salary, or they have $1 million net worth in their house, or they have $1 million portfolio in stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, I don't sell gold and silver. I don't, you know, I just buy gold and silver, and I hold it in a private vault that's guarded. What I'm trying to say to people, that's my plan B. Plan A for most people is paper, stocks. Bonds are the riskiest of all investment today. Stock market's at 18,000, the Dow, highest ever. Interest rates went negative. And mom and pop are in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and mining shares and all that stuff. Plan B would be I would go to hard assets, gold, silver, farmland, agriculture, cattle. I would go hard right now and get away from paper. Anything that is paper can be printed. That's what I said about all my fanatical friends in Bitcoin, and they're hacking. Terrorism keeps going up. The cell phone, the iPhone came out in 2007. 9/11 was 2001. Today, the cell phone is the weapon of choice behind terrorism. You know, you can use it to recruit fellow terrorists, or you can use it as an explosive trigger for IEDs. Person sitting there thinking their pension is safe, their 401k is safe, Janet Yellen's going to protect them, Obama cares, or Hillary or Trump are going to care for them, and you're all in paper. All I'm saying to people is go to real, tangible assets, plan B. Keep your 401k, keep your IRA, but start another plan where you're going real, hard assets. Plan B is hard assets, things that are not manipulated or printed. That's been my message forever.
You know, Robert Kiyosaki, we really appreciate the decade of help you've given us here on GoldSeek, and we appreciate your time. I want you to have a great weekend.
Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of Institutional Advisors.
Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Chris, and also with your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you back. And, you know, you just issued an advisory here. It says global warning exclamation point issued yesterday, October 4th. You say credit spreads are giving you some of the most ominous signs in years. Please tell us more.
Everybody watches the stock market. That's the big item. And in financial bubbles, of which we are in another one now, it's the stock market gets the attention. But underneath it, there's a whole lot of really interesting stuff going on. So what you have is the street generally analyzes the stock market. It looks at companies and balance sheets and earnings statements. And then it figures the Fed's going to look after everything. So I'm all looked after on the equity side. But, you know, even the very best of companies throughout history, and you look back at a runaway financial market, and then comes the hit, and the best of the companies go down as well. So we're looking at things that overwhelm corporate abilities. Then the next stage is you want to look at things that overwhelm the ambition of central bankers. And so you look underneath it all, and yes, central bankers can push interest rates down for a while. They used to just push at the short end, but now they've been pushing at the long end by buying bonds. Our contention is that when a credit market is ready to change, like back in 2009, it was ready to change for the good, and it's been on since. So now it's ready to change, let's call it, for the bad. So, and you look at it through the yield curve, which is the difference between long-term yields and short-term in one instrument like treasuries. And you look back in history, and the Federal Reserve has little control over that market when it's ready to change. And then you look at credit spreads, and that's the difference between high-grade instruments and low-grade ones. And again, that one, there's no, when it's ready to change, the Fed's got no power at all. So, and then there's one other, which I didn't put in that report yesterday, was real long interest rates, where you take the long yield and adjust it for the rate of CPI inflation, and they don't have any control over that one. So this is why we focus on these. So you see Wall Street all the time saying, oh, what the Fed is doing is great, or it should do this, or it should be a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it doesn't actually condemn the Fed as being ineffectual when the time comes for change. So the one we're looking at here is that in a few weeks ago, no, actually months ago now, the LIBOR rate started to increase, and it has increased enough to kind of shake the stock markets a little, but not yet a breakout. And then the one we did yesterday, that thing is getting ready to do a more serious move. So, it's sort of underneath the markets, and it's not totally invisible because you had a whole lot of investment funds that are fixed income sector. But the one we did yesterday was on the credit spreads, which is, to repeat, the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And, of course, this made an important change in 2015 when the price of crude started going down, and you had then about 18% of junk bond issues were in the oil patch. So then they were directly affected, and then, of course, you get the spread out from other things as it heads down. So you had spreads we're looking at the CCC high-yield instrument against treasuries, and it got out to 20% in last January when the panic was really on, and that was a very huge widening of spread. So you'd expect a rebound out, which is what we got, once the panic was over. And then you'd expect there's a good seasonal in this instrument, Chris, and it goes, you get narrowing into around June or July, which we got, and then it was moving strong enough that we thought, well, let's put some technical research on it. We looked at other periods of narrowing credit spreads, and we used the momentum thing on it, the RSI, and we wanted it to come into around 25, because that was an important turning point on previous setups. So anyways, yeah, so as of yesterday, it was into 26, and then there's that's the momentum. And then on the other one, we have a different technical tool called a sequential. It's a pattern when you get certain ups and downs over, in this case, 13 weeks. So we got now a sequential buy on credit spreads, which means widening, which means upsetting to the financial market. So this narrowing, which is party time, what needed last week was, on this one, was to have the have that credit spread continue to narrow for a bit, which it has done now, and that then locked in the sequential buy on it. So this one is fascinating to watch. It's very powerful stuff when it turns, and the central bankers have no power over it. So we'll just watch for this one to turn. And every day we'll check the LIBOR rate. It got out to 0.866 a month ago, and it corrected into 0.83. These are not large numbers, Chris, that we're talking about, but it's the important things is the turn, and now it's at 8.6. So if the LIBOR goes above, let's say, 0.87, then we're in trouble. The other one that backs us up, and I referred to it in thing, is we did one of these global warnings, not warnings. It was October 19th in 2007 where similar changes were developing, and the high for the S&P, I think, was, what was it, October the 12th or something. So we came out with the global warning, and one of the things that we like to do is, of course, we specialize in precious metals as well, and we found decades ago that the gold-silver ratio is very good at anticipating changes in the credit markets. As a matter of fact, we've called it the metallic credit spread, because when you're in good times or in a boom and you've got a rally going on for precious metals, silver will outperform gold. So you keep track of that ratio, and when you're heading for a high in here, or a while ago, the momentum on the silver-gold ratio will get up, and we use the daily RSI on that one. And if it gets sort of up above 80, that's dangerous territory. It shows a lot of speculation. So this one, we got that a month or so ago, and then more recently in, what was it, August, we got an outright sell on the gold stocks. So, and we were looking for a 20% plus decline in the general gold stocks, maybe accomplished by the end of September. And then last week, we updated it and looked at the charts, and we're not yet into a buying territory on this. It's not oversold enough yet. So the gold and silver stocks have further to decline. But to get back to the gold-silver ratio, now it sets a low with an investment boom, and that was a while ago, but we were looking at it recently here, and it had to break out above 70, and on Tuesday, I guess it was, yeah, it did. It's broken out. So now what we look at in the gold-silver ratio is that it's saying a heads up, it's an alert to changes in the credit market. And then, of course, this is what we mentioned in April of 2007. Sorry, that was in October 2007. was that we had the turn in the credit spreads, just beginning, and we also had the breakout in the gold-silver ratio, and a warning for us, of course, that indeed did turn out to be the top of the stock market. And then here we are now. You had, if you look at the New York Composite Index, NYA, it set its high, I think, September the 6th. You also had the, and that was, it just released last week, with, this week was the consumer confidence sentiment reading by the conference board. And it was at the highest since August 2007. So there's a lot of positives on consumer confidence and on the general stock market. But inside, for example, just this week now, you've had the New York Advanced Decline Index on the New York Stock Exchange. It's beginning to roll over, so the breadth of the market is changing. So, Chris, that's what we're looking for, is change, and the change is coming in on the credit markets with the yield curve. Oh, yeah, I didn't mention that one. Update it. Yeah, it made an important reversal a month and a half ago, and it's corrected back, and then as of this week, it's starting to head in the bad way again. So you've got the yield curve, credit spreads are changing to a warning on the overall party that's going on.
One of the top stories we haven't addressed yet last week was clearly the FOMC meeting. It looks like we will more than likely have a rate hike as soon as December, which could take us to 75 basis points on the overnight lending rate. The Fed funds future is predicting pretty solid odds after the 2016 presidential elections. We're looking for more than likely a rate hike, at least December or 2017. Any comments on how might that impact the market?
Not that the Fed policy is going to impact the market. It's that these changes in the credit markets that are going on now will impact the Fed. It'll force them to follow up and raise rates, which will not be helping things. But then this is where the interesting thing will be, is how do they explain raising rates in a disaster? So, no, if you take the history of the senior central bank, which now is the Federal Reserve and it used to be the Bank of England, at major changes in financial markets, like big changes from the bottom of a crash or the top of a bubble, changes in the administered rate of the central bank have been 4 or 5 months behind changes in market rates. So this is where it gets a little ironical, is that a whole lot of Fed watchers really think that Fed's running the thing. So they're making a living discussing what the Fed might do, ought to do, or should, when actually the Fed's following market forces.
But, you know, we do have to look at the core inflation rate, which is getting very close to their 2% target. Of course, that's what they've at least mentioned in previous meeting minutes, starting to show some signs of price increases, as one would expect. But I think you make an interesting point. Many of our guests take your stance and agree with you that is almost the tail wagging the dog. I wanted to move on, if we could, to another interesting topic. It seems to be on everybody's radar lately, and that's Deutsche Bank. This collapsing share price, not to mention the Justice Department fine, has one of Europe's most prominent lending institutions in the strongest economy within Europe. It has a lot of people concerned that we could see another maybe Bear Stearns / Lehman Brothers style 2008-2009 credit fueled meltdown. I'd like your thoughts on Deutsche Bank, whether or not you think their balance sheet is likely riddled, as are our money center banks here in the U.S., with toxic derivatives, mortgage-backed securities, CDSs, and CDOs?
Well, I haven't looked in detail at their balance sheet. All I know is that they're in a severe contraction. They were very aggressive in the financial markets, in creating instruments and leveraging them and all that sort of stuff. Then also, and I don't think anybody fully understands the issue that the U.S. has against Deutsche Bank, but all they wanted to do was grab $15 billion. These shouldn't be looked at as penalties or fines for misdeeds, because I don't think they can really identify the misdeed. This is just straight robber barons grabbing money. So then when the stock was selling off sharply a month ago, they met back, and then they came up with this $5.4 billion number, which happened to be the amount of money that they had in one reserve in their accounting or something or other. So they said, oh, well, we'll be happy with that. So this is just straight robber barons. It's evil. But then on the other hand, you have a very large financial institution that has been acting recklessly, and the market is putting their stock down until recently. So, yes, as regarding going back to 2008, it was June, when it was discovered that Bear Stearns had a problem. Then they took the hit, and the Fed, of course, became very aggressive, and it thought that that was it. And this is where the concept of the lender of last resort fell apart completely, because the lender of last resort idea is that if you fix one bank, and then nothing will spread. But the guys who dreamt up the idea never really fully understood that in a bubble, all lending institutions get offside, or let's say 99% of them do, because it's a you know, birds flocking together situation. So, yes, you have a very important financial institution that is contracting. I don't see anything that would stop the contraction or turn it around and get them expanding again, because people have become wary and taking their deposits or their business elsewhere. 1931, when the markets had rebounded out of the first crash, and then you had Credit Anstalt in Austria, which was a very big bank in Europe. And it was discovered to have a problem, but there was more to it than just Credit Anstalt, because in the first hit in 1929 and into 1930, the authorities in Austria forced Credit Anstalt to help out some other banks. They might have wanted to protect their balance sheet, but they were forced to. So then it was May 1931 when it was discovered that it was hopeless. So that then put the next leg down to the series crash right down into 1932. Yes, one bank getting into trouble is important. It'll be another test of whether the authorities can keep it at just one bank. But the problem is that any number of lending institutions have become aggressive. And then the other thing that's being now fully understood is that the zero interest rate nonsense is really harming commercial banks and insurance companies. It is really harmful. But it's interesting to look back on it, because it is a major flaw in the concept of intervention. And their idea is that if you do something flick like now, like kicking a football, then it changes everything.
You're talking about the mechanics and science of chaos theory and complexity theory. They failed to recognize that the butterfly flapping its wings in Singapore, right, can cause a hurricane perhaps in the Gulf of Mexico, i.e. we're not always certain of the implications and reverberations of the seemingly subtle policymaker action.
Now, you see, in 09... you know, they recovered. You know, the panic was over, the expansion started, but it was never enough for them arbitrarily. So then they keep punting. They can't leave well enough alone. This is what I guess I'm trying to say. So the hit, like the sharp drop in rates, and then a big hit of QE, was supposed to create strong economic growth. It hasn't.
because the framework, the foundation that was in place in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even part of the 80s has been eroded to such a point. It really is the proverbial pushing on a string. I think it's best illustrated by the fact that we've had interest rates at zero or NERP or near zero or now below zero. It's Sweden, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and 3.75% negative rates with the People's Bank of China. The fact that we've held rates so low for so long, and we haven't had the economic boom that you're referring to.
Yeah, well, also part of the problem beyond being in a post-bubble contraction is that there's so many rules and regulations put into business and commerce and industry that it's constrained. But then you got another set of guys at the central bank who arbitrarily decide growth isn't strong enough, and they've got this theory that if they add more credit, it'll add growth, and it isn't working. But now they are finally to the point, and Deutsche Bank is one telltale here, and there are other, at this point, nameless insurance companies, and whether casualty or life or whatever, that are in an impossible situation. So the what was considered as good has run so long that it has now become bad. And the system will change. And again, it's looking at the ancient old credit spreads, yield curve, and they're beginning to change in the direction that says watch out. So, but what I've been writing on a bigger picture stuff is that the a recession is inevitable, a bear market from a bubble is inevitable. Perhaps it's starting, but even without that, is that with the inevitability, you will then have a condition where the average taxpayer is going to look at things and say, look at, you spent trillions of our dollars on our risk, pushing your theories. So I think that the central banks will be reformed, not from within, but by a pissed-off electorate and taxpayer who's saying it's not working. And from time to time, there's a lot of common sense within the public. And all it is revealing is that there's never been any common sense in the concept of interventionist central banking. We do live in interesting times, Chris. Started off by saying that they're getting successful at getting inflation up to 2%, and they've been frustrated with this. Now, I started in the business in 63 with the premier investment dealer in Canada. I mean, this was like Goldman Sachs with integrity. So and then I was in the research department in the head office in Toronto at 65. And that's when inflation was getting worrying. CPI inflation was getting up to 1% or something like that. So I was new to the bond market and thought, I ended up talking with the vice president, the senior vice president of bonds, who was then an elderly man, but he'd had a full career in the bond market. So I said, isn't this a concern because you're the threat to the principal? And you have the threat to the amount of income you're getting. And he says, oh, it is. But he said, serious inflation only happens in lesser countries, such as in Europe or in South America, but never in Canada, the United States, or England.
We just got a call opening up the digital mailbag.
John here, now residing in sunny San Diego. You know, all the big news lately is Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank. Of course, we knew they were in trouble a long time ago, but maybe one of your guests could draw the parallel between the Kreditanstalt, which failed about 1930 and brought down just about every European bank there was in the wake of its collapse. This looks like it's setting up to be another Kreditanstalt. And imagine, that was back in the 1930s before they had the internet. It's getting very interesting. I think we're going to have a very interesting October, don't you? Maybe Deutsche Bank will be the catalyst to finally break the stranglehold that the bullion bankers have on gold and silver. Keep up the good work.
We have John from San Diego. He's a regular listener and a prolific caller. He draws parallels between the current Deutsche Bank fiasco and the Kreditanstalt, I believe, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, of the 1930s, which he claims brought down many, if not most, of the major European banks.
And they had been forced to bail out a lesser bank, which impaired their balance sheet, so that then when credit markets began to change, I guess, May of 1931, all of a sudden, they were gone. It should be considered, it wasn't that Kreditanstalt caused the severe contraction. The severe contraction was on, and Kreditanstalt was the big name that failed. So here you have early stages of a credit contraction, and at the moment, the Deutsche Bank happens to be the big name. There'd be all kinds of smaller or lesser or even moderate-sized names that you and I can't know about, sort of waiting in the wings. So this will be a serious condemnation of the central bank concept of the lender to last resort, where they come in and fix one, then there's no problem. But the problem is that in a boom, 90% of the lending agencies get ambitious and get into troubles. And it's human nature's way. It's been that way. You read about mortgage market collapse in Rome, in ancient Rome. Cicero writes that where there was important commercial and financial center there, Cicero writes that if there is a problem in the remote provinces, that financial problem will eventually hit in Rome. And that's the way it works. So here you now, New York is the financial center of the world. London is right up there close to it now. And you've got a problem in Germany, which is an important country. Anyways, there may be a problem suddenly come out of China or Asia. So I think a serious contraction is unavoidable.
Thank you, John, for another very interesting comment and question. Maybe shift the dialogue really back to the precious metals. I think your assessment was right. Obviously, we've been watching multi-week consolidation. There's plenty of downside risk on the XAU in the near term, and we haven't even reached the 200-day moving average yet on the weekly charts for either gold or the XAU. Some wiggle room there. We're expecting continued buying opportunities, though, because some of our favorite sentiment indexes, despite the fact that we were overbought and in need of a correction, are still registering, you might say, stubbornly strong and robust momentum readings, suggests the bull market may remain intact despite the sell-off.
Our advice in early August was that it would be the first significant correction in what is otherwise a new bull market for gold that began, you know, January, let's say. You know, it took a while to get everything sorted out. But, yeah, this is a cyclical bull market for precious metals. And it'll be mainly due to the price of gold advancing relative to the cost of mining. It won't be due to gold going to $5,000 or $10,000. There's actually no rational way that one can come up with a $10,000 gold target. It's
I think there's confusion because there are those who haven't done the due diligence that have taken credit, if you will, for these pie-in-the-sky numbers. And you're right, it sells newsletters. In this case, it'd be sensationalism. Nevertheless, there is some interesting work in this area by solid researchers like yourself, one of whom, Nick Barisha. But his analysis is very compelling for the case for $10,000 gold. Of course, he published a well-received book, $10,000 Gold, about to publish a follow-up to that as well. He looks at the allocation, or I should say lack of allocation, to the precious metals throughout the world's pension funds. Okay, so let's say there's $4 trillion in pension funds in Tokyo, a trillion or two in China, and in Europe and the United States. And he's recognized that there's virtually none, maybe a quarter of 1%. It's a negligible, not even fractional number. If we were to even return to some semblance of the norm in the allocation there for a balanced portfolio, you would be looking at a minimum target of $10,000 gold.
Yeah, but I've found trying to analyze supply demand and go to price is at best guesswork. But let's just go through the historical way that I've done it, whereby in each post-bubble contraction, you get the real or deflated price of gold goes up for about 20 years. And the gold mining then becomes the premier industry. So let's say the real price over the next decade doubles. You know, all these marginal producers are going to make money like you wouldn't believe. So who cares for a target of 10,000 when all you need to know is that it's going to be the premier industry for investment, and then at highs, like let's call them intermediate highs, you're going to have some really good speculative action. That's all you need to know, that this is the best game in town. It's correcting now, and next year it'll be back to being the best game in town again.
What I think is really key here is for folks not to get too discouraged. We don't see any signs of a resumption of a bear market, but the ascent, you know, the rebound from the lows were awfully vertical.
Yeah, the XAU go from 99 to 280.
I think that's the HUI.
HUI was absolutely outstanding. And then there were some Midland-sized ones that, whoo, absolutely fantastic. Some of the silver stock, Majestic Silver, these were fabulous. The thing to do is to play the stocks. Now, our technical work, which gave us the high recently, I think it was the 1st of July, also is designed where we have an upside exhaustion on that model. It gives us a downside capitulation when the intermediate low is coming in. Then also we have a pattern. It's not based upon momentum, but it gives us, like in the summer, a sequential sell. So then at lows, it gives the sequential buy. So we have two tools for lightening up, and then another, then the same tool and same technical tools give us the time and the opportunity when it's time to add to your portfolio. So, and this actually worked for us back in 2011. Then this one, that was the silver gold ratio. The RSI on that got up to 92, and the only, and we're very careful to point out, the only other time in history that you had it up to 92 was January 1980 on that huge high. And we called for a cyclical bear market. There were some good trades in it, definitely good trades. And then it was November last year when we sat down and said, look, we're getting the opposites to what we had in 2011, and sat down and built a case for getting back into the market on lows perhaps around Christmas or into January. And it did work out. I think the low was late January, but, and it was nervous getting in, as any of these things are. So, but the correction in gold stocks has further to go, but it is a correction within a cyclical bull market.
Bob Hoy, we'd certainly like to know more about institutional advisors, the services we can expect to find, how we can sign up.
Look at institutionaladvisors.com. A quicker way is just to Google my name, Bob Hoy, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E. And you get into our site, and there's all the archival stuff. There's provocative essays on markets or central banks or even climate change, of all things. So it's an interesting place to hang out for a little while, and we'd welcome trial subscriptions.
Very good. Thank you, Bob Hoy.
Anytime, Chris. Look forward to the next one.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio.
Thank you very much.
Finally, after nearly a decade of holding rates at impossibly low levels, the Fed raised rates. Nevertheless, their counterparts in Europe and in other parts of the world are actually considering going further into negative territory. Do you see this as dollar supportive, and just what might it mean for the global currency world?
I'm aware that just about anyone under the sun is so optimistic about the U.S. dollar. This is a view I do not necessarily share, because I do not expect the Fed to continue increasing rates. On the contrary, I think that sometimes in 2016, the Fed will again cut rates, and more likely than not, launch QE4.
QE4, I assume that would mean we'd be looking at further monetary easing plans, and we would see the purchase of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, other derivatives, as well as treasuries to hold the market in place. There simply aren't enough buyers worldwide for the U.S. Treasury and for our toxic mortgage debt.
I think the economy is not very responsive any longer, and that applies to all countries in the world, to expansionary monetary policies, because they've been practiced for so long. So the impact is now diminishing. And there are many factors, aside from monetary policies and fiscal policies, that have an impact on the economy. And my sense is that the way the stock market has behaved, where the average stock is down more than 20%, but the indices are still holding up because of just a few stocks, that this is actually quite reflective of the U.S. economy, where a few companies and a few sectors are still doing okay, but the majority of sectors and the majority of people, the median household, workers, the middle class, isn't doing well at all. So my view would be it's more likely that the U.S. will go into recession within the next 3 months if we are not yet in recession, because industrial production is already down. Exports are down. Imports are down. These are quite powerful indicators. Of course, then the government publishes figures about employment, but these are vastly distorted figures, because if you have one job, you are fired, and then you take two part-time jobs, then statistically one job has been lost, but two have been created. So a lot of statistics are very questionable in the U.S.
You know, underemployment is certainly a big problem, as well as record levels of poverty, or at least near poverty, with approximately 50 million Americans accepting food stamps to help keep dinner on the table. We also have other leading indicators, economic indicators, that are flashing at least yellow. Manufacturing rollover heavily in the United States, which tends to precede a recession.
Yes, the signs are all there that unlike all the strategists and economists who a year predicted a strengthening U.S. economy and a healing of the global economy, we have actually in most emerging markets already a recession or no growth or a very severe growth slowdown, with some sectors being in recession. All the economies in the world that depend on resources are basically in a recession. And in the U.S., and I wrote about this already 4 years ago, we have nowadays an economy and a social system that has a lot of resemblances to a banana republic.
We also have a bifurcated economy, I think you alluded to earlier. On the one hand, we see the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index plunging to lows not seen in years, another leading indicator. But then on the other, we see the retail sector holding up surprisingly well. Strength in retail, could that be correlated to perhaps higher debt levels, giving us the illusion of strength in that sector?
Well, I mean, we have to analyze how well retail is holding up. Because if I look at all the retail stores in the U.S., the performance of their stocks has been horrible. Horrible, not just bad, but horrible. And now someone can come and say, well, this is due that people buy now online, and so the traditional retailers are all suffering and so forth. I don't buy this argument entirely. What has been strong in retailing and in consumption have been, for instance, auto sales. And auto sales have been driven largely by credit. We have now a car loan industry that is over $1 trillion, car loans. And what has also been strong are home improvement items. In other words, the Home Depots have done well. But this has also a lot to do with the fact that people don't buy homes anymore, but they improve their existing homes. Or parents, they need some new furniture for their siblings who will stay at home, can't afford an apartment anymore. So this is also a debatable statistic whether that is so healthy.
We also have had difficulty in the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate crude plunging into low 30s, perhaps on its way to the 20s. That is good for the consumer, the largest component of our domestic economy. But then, of course, you also have the difficulties that stem from the large number of energy sectors in the S&P 500 weighing heavily on that sector, and, of course, jobs as well. Any comments on the energy sector?
Well, I mean, this country with the largest industrial sector as a percent of GDP is South Korea. But the problem is that South Korea doesn't benefit much from falling commodity prices, because their exports to commodity producers, including the Middle East, are larger than their exports to the EU and the U.S. combined. So when the customers have less money, they also buy less from South Korea. And so net, the benefit actually is very, very minor or even negative. In the case of South Korea, December exports were down 13%. In the U.S., the consumer would be a prime beneficiary from low energy prices. Unfortunately, the U.S. has a president that found it necessary that for most people, insurance premiums are rising by 20, 30, 40% per annum at the present time. And, you know, for people who have a lot of money, say you make $1 million a year, it doesn't matter whether your health insurance premium goes up by 30%. But if you're a family of four and middle class or working family, it makes a big difference. And if you have a car, yes, you benefit from lower oil prices, but if at the same time the tunnel fees, the toll roads, and the tolls at bridges all go up by double digits, it doesn't help you very much. So all these things have been offset to a large extent by extremely poor policies by the U.S. government.
The precious metals, a lot of aficionados in the audience here today. Higher rates ahead doesn't seem to bode too well for the metal, at least in the United States. But then with your forecast of perhaps Fed officials and policymakers having to backpedal, that might be the panacea that the precious metals bulls need.
Well, first of all, we had already a bear market in gold of more than 40% since September 2001. In other words, the bear market is more than 4 years old. Gold, compared to other assets, to stocks, bonds, and most currencies, in my view, is not particularly expensive. And the gold shares have started to outperform other stocks. And so I'm actually quite optimistic for gold to perform better than the S&P and better than other indices in 2016. In fact, I think that sentiment has been so negative recently about gold and gold shares that there is a significant upside potential. That would be my view. I'm not sure it's good news. But good news, basically, for someone who wants to buy gold would be for the gold price first to decline and provide a great buying opportunity, you understand? But I think already here it's at a very attractive level. So I bought some additional gold. Of course, I always buy gold, but on this weakness in the last month, I increased my position.
With the shocking increase in yields, it certainly doesn't seem to bode well for the debt and bond sector. Of course, stocks under pressure worldwide with Chinese policymakers and officials putting the brakes, their Shanghai index at least last week. You're obviously becoming a little more sanguine regarding the yellow metal. Do you see other interesting opportunities ahead in the commodities sector?
Yes. I mean, the same analysts who a year ago or 2 years ago were predicting oil to go to $150. Now they say it will go to 20. I don't know whether it will go to 20 or not, but my sense is that between this level and 20, the market is very inexpensive. And my view would be that we could have a sharp rebound. Maybe not. I mean, maybe, most likely not to new highs, but say to an equilibrium price of between, say, $40 and $60, maybe $70. So, yes, I think in the commodities complex, there are now opportunities. I have to say that for individuals, to play the commodity markets is not that simple. First of all, they need a futures account. And many people in the U.S. they don't want to have a futures account, or they don't know how to open one. Then they buy ETFs, commodity ETFs. Commodity ETFs are just about the worst investment anyone can ever make, because the rollover cost is far too high. So if a commodity, if you buy a commodity ETF and the commodity doesn't go up 30% in a year, you will probably lose money. Physical gold, the storage cost is relatively low, and you can buy physical gold and you don't have to roll it over. So I would buy, if you really believe in a commodities rebound, my belief would be that precious metals would actually outperform other commodities.
And it also has the added benefits of avoiding rehypothecation and related issues that have come up all over the world, not to mention potential confiscation issues, margin-related problems, and just a time where regulations and policies are coming into place that I think the typical investor may not be prepared for. The middle class used to be the backbone, if you will, of societies in the Western world, and it really was the aspiration of the working classes that their progeny might reach the goal of the middle class. That was really the dream that drove, I think, so much of the economic, and still does today to some extent. But we've just seen at least erosion of the middle class in the United States, maybe not so much in China and other BRIC nations. Can you give tips to the American middle class listeners today to help improve their economic situation?
Well, when I look back at the 50s and 60s and how rich Americans were relative to the rest of the world. I'm talking here relative. American workers, they earned a lot of money. They could go to Europe on holidays and live in Europe far above the life standard of Europeans, because the dollar at the time was very strong. It bought over 4 Deutschmark and 4 Swiss francs, whereas now it buys exactly about 1 Swiss franc. So a lot of things have changed in the world. We have, in the Western world, not just in the U.S., a generation of people that will die poorer and earn less in real terms, inflation adjusted, than their parents in the 50s and 60s. Whereas in emerging economies, I can say that in China, we didn't have a middle class 30 years ago. And if I measure, say, a middle class, a simple indicator would be how many people can go on holidays and how many people can buy a car and so forth. So in China, for instance, in the mid-80s, there were less than 5 million Chinese traveling overseas. They were not allowed. And then by year 2000, there were 10 million Chinese traveling overseas, and now there are 120 million Chinese traveling overseas every year. With a shift in the balance of economic power, and it is, say, sad for me to see that the Western world has lost, relatively speaking, so much in such a brief period of time. And the only explanation I have for this loss in relative prosperity in such a short period of time are, and I can't use the word I would like to use, the government's idiotic policies and their interventions into free markets and with monetary policies that then lead to essentially an enrichment of few people, very few people, not 1%, 0.01%, and essentially an impoverishment of the majority of people. The media, they have been bought by the government, or their owners are bought by the government. They will always paint a nice picture of what is happening in the economy, because they just watch the stock market and they watch Wall Street and New York, that lives essentially from tourists. And the money printing that flows first into the financial sector. So, of course, there is the trickle-down effect in New York, but it hasn't really reached Main Street.
Perhaps you'd like to share with us a brief overview of your perspective on the year 2016, this new year.
Well, I think I mentioned before in interviews, I don't think the stock market will go up and that it will close lower and that we will drop between 20 and 40% from the May 2015 high, essentially 2,134. However, I'm not the clairvoyant about what the Fed will do and other central banks. I think, as I mentioned in just now, that the Fed will embark on QE4, but to really have an impact and push markets to new highs, they will have to do a massive QE4. I would imagine in the order of $150 billion asset purchase every month. And whether politically that will be acceptable is debatable because the elections are coming up.
Well, thanks again, Dr. Faber, for another excellent economic overview. We wish you an excellent 2016.
Thank you very much.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. This month marks the ninth year of my commentaries and analysis on GoldSeek.com Radio. Over that time, throughout the economic crisis, I have analyzed comments issued by the Fed that forecast a series of future expectations that never quite seemed to arrive.
Big guests, be sure to check out next week's show.
Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen spoke at the Fed's Jackson Hole, Wyoming Symposium by delivering a speech entitled "Designing Resilient Monetary Policy."
The gold and silver
future.
Mining sector is
the
red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity,
framework.
Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Carneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares.
But instead,
what herein
we've really
should be construed as investment advice.
Pattern of talk.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Real estate remains a critical song for the canary in the financial coal mine we have all been navigating since the ongoing implosion of the financial system in 2008. A report issued by appraiser Miller Samuel and brokerage Douglas Elliman Real Estate detailed how sales of previously owned condominiums and co-ops in Manhattan fell 20% in the third quarter of 2016, down from a year earlier, as buyers became much more cautious as more inventory has flooded onto real estate markets in an attempt for current owners to cash out. The report cited that for Manhattan, there were 5,290 resale apartments on the market at the end of September, which is 53% more than the number of apartments that were available on the market in late 2013, which was the lowest point for listings. More property owners are listing their apartments in an attempt to profit from these rising prices. But the pendulum is starting to slow down and move in the opposite direction, as fewer people are actually buying. Quoted in a Bloomberg article, Jonathan Miller, president of Miller Samuel, said, "Rapidly rising prices over the years have pulled more sellers into the market, hoping to cash out. But buyers are more wary. There isn't the same intensity of activity to burn through the new supply." For many listeners who track the real estate market like I do in certain locales in the U.S., you've probably noticed an uptick, and in some cases a significant uptick in home values over the past year in particular, and a corresponding increase in the number of homes coming onto the market, as described in the Manhattan Apartment Report. Prices of real estate, not just in Manhattan, but in real estate markets across the country, have increased over the past 3 years, and lots of people are looking to cash out. Check out the price tax history on any homes you might be tracking in markets of interest on Zillow.com. It's a quick way to glimpse the price action on a specific property over the past decade. Some are investors who bought in the past 2 to 5 years. Some are first-time casualties from the ongoing 2008 financial crisis. And yes, it's still ongoing. And some are likely the beginning influx of what is set to become the rocket fuel that will impact the real estate market between now and 2018, when roughly 3 million homeowners who still have home equity lines of credit, better known as HELOCs, taken out in the bubble years of 2005 to 2008, before the financial crisis, the HELOCs those homeowners possess will begin to recast themselves over the next 3 years as fully amortizing loans and dramatically drive up monthly payment obligations for millions of homeowners. How much could it drive up payments? Consider, as an example, that during the fourth quarter of 2005, during the peak bubble years of writing HELOCs, the average HELOC was more than $130,000. The Los Angeles Times analyzed the distress of a real borrower in 2014 with a $167,000 HELOC in Huntington Beach, California. He received a notice from his mortgage servicer that the HELOC would convert to a fully amortizing loan in 2016, and his monthly payment would increase from $400 to $1,100 per month. The challenge is, it's now 10 years later, and circumstances have dramatically changed since the loan was originated in 2006. He and his spouse are both on fixed incomes and are unable to make the payment. Lots of people, lots of older people, who may have escaped the immediate carnage of the 2008 financial crisis, may be about to see a change of fortune for the worse. I believe the influx of homes coming onto the market will continue regardless of whether prices remain at this semi-inflated level or drop noticeably because of too much supply, or drop dramatically due in part or whole because of a disruption in the markets. Those with decade-old HELOCs baked into their immediate financial future, who cannot afford higher payments, are going to be watching the real estate off-ramps like a hawk. Absent some newfangled program that allows them to extend their HELOC as interest only for another 10 years, if they see too much congestion to the downside, then there will be a bigger influx of homes hitting the market much sooner instead of over the next 2 years. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and join my new email list. I've been gearing up for some time now to provide new content and special features, which are just around the corner, so please direct your browser to conquerchange.com and sign up today. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers. Plus, their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.